Today we're pleased to welcome Savas down from Stanford University. Savas has made many contributions to particle physics, including the first work on supersymmetry as a solution to the hierarchy problem, and a great deal of work on supersymmetric gradient unification and phenomenology. Also early work on the alternative idea of technicolor, and many new ideas about quark and lepton masses and baryogenesis. The common pattern here is a focus on new physics that might be seen as particle accelerators or in cosmology or astrophysics. So you wouldn't expect to see Savas' name on a paper about quantum gravity or string theory or extra dimensions, and you wouldn't expect him to draw pictures of Z-brains on his blackboard. But a few years ago, Savas and collaborators noticed that all of these things, instead of being way up at where we think of Planck scale was, might in fact be at a much more accessible energy scale. And that's what he's going to tell us about today, submillimeter dimensions and quantum gravity at GEV.
Okay, thank you, Drew. Okay, so here is the... So as Joe said, I'll talk about submillimeter dimensions and quantum gravity at a TEV. And this is work done in collaboration with Nima Arkani-Hamed from Stanford, Yead Valley from ICTP and New York University. And also later on, I'll mention some work in collaboration with Ignatius Antoniadis and John March Russell. Standard framework for particle physics that has been with us at least until 1974 is based on the so-called desert paradigm, and it's based on the existence of two scales, the weak scale and the Planck mass. Weak scale is the scale where electroweak unification happens. The Planck mass is presumed to be the scale where gravity unifies with all the other forces. Now, it is worthwhile to ask how much we know about gravity, up to what distances has gravity been tested relative to the Planck mass. And to do that, I have an experimental transparency here. It shows the strength of a force relative to gravity on the vertical axis as a function of distance on the horizontal axis. So here you have a centimeter all the way down to 1 micron, and force, this is 10 to the 0, is 1 times gravity. Okay. So the region above the red line is experimentally excluded by a variety of combination of experiments, Cavendish-like, Casimir force-type experiments. And the region below the red line is experimentally allowed. What you see from this transparency is that at a distance, that gravity has been measured at distance of order of 1 millimeter, and in particular, at distances as large as 100 microns or 10 microns, you can have forces which are a million or even 10 to the 8 times as big as gravity. Recently, there are at least two experimental groups that I know of that are trying to improve this state of affairs and propose experiments that will probe the region above this green line. And these are groups based at Stanford as well as at Colorado. So in view of this state of affairs, in view... Yes, I will mention them in the middle of my talk. Okay. So in view of this state of affairs, it seems worthwhile to question the extrapolation that we make from millimeter distances that correspond to energies of about 10 to the minus 4 electron volt all the way to the Planck mass. So the actual state of affairs with respect to the standard paradigm of particle physics is more like this, that we have two deserts. One is the gauge desert, where we extrapolate by 16 orders of magnitude, and the other is a gravitational desert where we extrapolate by 32 orders of magnitude. What we are going to discuss is a possible alternative to these ideas. The enormity of both of these deserts clearly suggests that there must be some alternate ideas with new physics populating either one of these deserts. And we are going to discuss what is perhaps an extreme example of such a possibility in the rest of the talk. So the rest, here is the outline. First I will outline the framework. Then I'll discuss why, if it is alive, and I'll discuss laboratory astrophysical and cosmological considerations. Experimental signatures, I'll talk about tabletop experiment like David requested, and also accelerator experiments. And finally, I'll talk about how you do physics inside the extra dimensions. Let me begin with the framework. Now, the basic idea of the framework is to just say that the Planck scale is to be identified, the fundamental Planck scale is to be identified with the electroweak scale. Okay? So we'll postulate that both of these scales are in the neighborhood of about 1,000 GeV. So this implies in particular that gravity gets strong and quantum gravity gets important at a far earlier energy, experimentally accessible energy. Immediate question is, how can you reconcile this with the observed weakness of gravity? Previously it was the largeness of the Planck mass that accounted for the weakness of gravity. And here we will postulate, we will invoke a new possibility for the weakness of gravity, namely that gravity lives in more than three spatial dimensions. Simplest way, there are many ways to see that this can explain the weakness of gravity. Perhaps the simplest way is the following. Consider these horizontal planes here to be our three-dimensional space, and imagine that there is some new dimensions, n of them, of size r. So consider now a point mass m somewhere in this space. The gravitational field of this point mass near of the point mass at distances much shorter than the size of the extra dimensions doesn't know that there are that these extra dimensions are of finite size, so the gravitational field drops like 1 over r to the 2 plus n with a constant given by the higher dimensional, which is the higher dimensional Newton constant. The gravitational field, once you start going to larger and larger distances, you eventually reach the size of the extra dimensions. Once you reach the size of the extra dimensions, the gravitational field lines cannot continue spreading anymore, so the gravitational field reverts back to its usual canonical 1 over r square behavior. Now, matching these two equations, these two forms of the gravitational field at distances smaller and larger than r, you are led to the following equation, that the higher dimensional, that the four-dimensional Planck scale is squared is equal to the higher dimensional Planck scale to 2 plus n power times the volume of the extra dimensions. And as you can see, this relation, of course, you can derive, is known since forever. It can be traced back to Gauss's law. It's a consequence of Gauss's law and was, of course, known to Kaluza and Klein since the early 20s. Okay. So now, what does this equation teach us about what? Okay, so here is this equation again, rewritten. What this equation teaches us is that even if the fundamental that the fundamental Planck scale can small can be as small as 1 TeV, and provided that the size or the volume of the extra dimensions is very large, this can account for the observed enormity of the four-dimensional Planck mass or the weakness of gravity. Okay? So plugging in for M Planck the value of a TeV, we obtain the following equation, that the size of the extra dimensions is given by this formula in centimeters. Now for n equal 1, you immediately see that this possibility is excluded because r would be 10 to the 13 centimeters. This is of astronomical distance, it's of the order of the Earth-Sun distance, so this is excluded from Newton's time. So you immediately see that this idea is not at all easy to implement, and in fact its simplest implementation is already excluded experimentally. Now, if you have two extra dimensions, interestingly, you find that the size of the extra dimensions has to be about a millimeter to account for the value of the Planck mass. And as you go to more and more extra dimensions, their size can decrease. And for example, for six extra dimensions, the size is like 10 Fermi. And of course, as you add more and more dimensions, the eventual size goes towards the TeV. Okay? Now, the decrease in the distance as you increase the number of dimensions, again, is not at all surprising. It's just a consequence of Gauss's law. The more the number of dimensions that you have, the more you dilute the force law by Gauss's law, and therefore the less the size of the extra dimensions that you need to account for the weakness of gravity. Now, of course, although very little is known about gravity at distances below a millimeter, a lot is known about QED and all the other forces. So, in the framework that we will discuss, we will postulate that all the standard model particles live on a three-dimensional wall, which sometimes we will refer to as a free brain, okay, three-dimensional wall. That gravity, as we said before, lives in a 3 plus n dimensional space. This extra space, this higher dimensional space, will be called the bulk. And of course, as we said before, that all the forces, including gravity, become of the same order of strength around the TeV scale, and that is to be identified with the Planck mass. So, a pictorial way to remember the framework is outlined here. So all forces, electromagnetic forces, quarks, leptons, and everything we know lives on a three-dimensional space, three-dimensional wall. Gravity, the graviton can live in higher dimensions, and the gravitational field of a particle spread itself into extra dimensions, where this of course is not drawn to scale. This is the size of the extra dimensions, and there are n of them. Now, sometimes, as you will see a little later on, it will be convenient to have a slightly less anthropocentric view of what is going on. Here we focused very specifically on the three-dimensional wall on which we happen to live. In reality, it will be useful to contemplate later on that there are other three-dimensional walls on which interesting physics can originate. So, it's convenient to have this picture in mind. This is just a picture of the bulk, okay? Here is the bulk, the extra n dimensions. This is their size. Here is the bulk. This is us. This is our three-dimensional space has been reduced to just a point. And so far, what we have said is that we have graviton that can live in this higher, that can propagate in the bulk. And as I said, later on, we will see that a lot of physics that can happen in the bulk, that in fact, the bulk will be the arena for new phenomena and new mechanisms for physics. Okay. This is... Now let me move to the second topic, which is whether the framework is alive, and I want to discuss laboratory astrophysical and cosmological aspects of this question. The first thing you might worry is some extremely simple consideration. Do you change the gravitational energetics of big objects such as stars? Okay. And the answer in this case is clearly no, for a very simple reason. If you compute the gravitational energy of a big object such as a star, because of the long-range nature of gravity, of ordinary 3 plus 1 dimensional gravity, the vast amount, the energetics or the energy of the star is vastly dominated by particles that are very far away in the star. And you can see this very clearly, the gravitational energy per unit volume scales like a positive power of the size. And this is just a consequence of the fact that the gravitational potential drops like just one over r. So, shortly, if you play with physics, if you change physics at sub-millimeter scales, that has very little effect on the bulk dynamics of a big object. However, of course, once you postulate that gravity becomes strong at the TV, there is a lot more that you have to worry about, and there are two classes of issues that you have to worry about. First, when you have any new physics at the TV, whether it's new, whether it's strong gravity or it's technicolor or it's supersymmetry, anything of left-right models that you may want to consider at the TV, there is a long list of questions that you have to immediately answer. For example, and these questions have to do with either rare processes or not so rare processes about which quite a bit is known, such as the G-2 of the electron, for example. So, and I will come to this later, the generic way in which such problems are solved is that some of these processes, in particular the very rare ones such as KK bar or proton decay, can be protected by symmetries or approximate symmetries. And those that are not protected by symmetries, because they don't violate any, in fact, are adequately small because of decoupling once you're talking about scales at a TeV or between 1 and 10 TeV. So at the moment, I won't say too much about these things, although I will return to the things like proton decay and at the end of my talk. All the ones that are, as I said before, that are protected by that are not protected by symmetries are protected adequately by decoupling, by the statement that the new physics doesn't emerge until after a TeV. Okay. So that is one class of problems. There is a vastly more difficult problem, which is intrinsic to the framework that we are discussing here. Namely, that once you say that the scale of quantum gravity is a TeV, then effectively you are introducing 10 to the 32 graviton-like objects. These are called the Kaluza-Klein excitations of the graviton, or you can think of this as being the effective number of degrees of freedom that you've introduced below a TeV, each and every one of them coupled with a normal gravitational strength. So, a priori introducing light particles is well known to be problematic. A classic example is the axion, which is more than excluded at a TeV. In fact, its scale has to be more like 10 to the 10 GeV. So in view of that, introducing 10 to the 32 light graviton seems to be disastrous. And there is a large number of processes one has to check. Here is several of them. So in the lab, for example, you have to worry about rare processes like kaon going to pion plus invisible, missing energy signatures in accelerators. If you can produce new light particles, they carry energy, they go away. Astrophysical consideration. You have to worry about stellar dynamics in general. You have to worry about sun, red giants, and supernova. These I have listed concretely because these are the main considerations, especially the supernova, that constrain the axion. And finally, you have to worry about cosmological considerations, in particular and especially nucleosynthesis, which is one of the fundamentals of the Big Bang cosmology, overclosing the universe, distorting the gamma ray spectrum. So I'll discuss, I won't discuss all of them, I'll actually discuss the most difficult or the most problematic cases for the most part. The only thing that we need to know to discuss all of these, the problems associated with the new 10 to the 32 new graviton states, is to know how the graviton couples to matter. And that's very simple to figure out. Here is a single graviton emission amplitude, which is what we are interested in, is proportional to the square root of a force, graviton-mediated force, which in n plus 4 dimensions, and if you have n extra dimensions, goes like, of course, the square root of the corresponding g newton. And in n plus 4 dimensions, g newton scales like 1 over the fundamental Planck scale to the n plus 2 power square root of that. So once you know that, you can define the following extremely interesting quantity, which is You can define, of course, you can compute the rate for single graviton emission, it's just the square of the amplitude. And if you are interested in a specific process with a given available energy, characteristic energy, delta E, then a dimensionless number that characterizes the graviton emission rate is simply given by dimensional analysis. It's inversely proportional to the fundamental Planck scale to the n plus 2 power and proportional to the available energy to the same power. Very important point, and somewhat counterintuitive perhaps, is that the more the number of extra dimensions that you have, the safer this number gets, the safer it is. Let me repeat it a little better. If for any given process where there is a fixed amount of available energy, the higher the number of extra dimensions, the smaller the dimensionless graviton coupling. Why is that? This is just a consequence of Gauss's law. Because delta is much less than m. Of course, when we reach the Planck, the fundamental Planck scale, we will see new phenomena. That's right. Okay. So this is, and of course the reason for that is just Gauss's law. The more the number of extra dimensions, the more gravity dilutes itself in the infrared. So this is an important issue. It's a golden rule to keep in mind for all the estimates that we will do in the next few transparencies. Another corollary of this simple formula is that the most constraint will be obtained from the highest available energies for which you have detailed information. For example, when we come to cosmology, the most constraint will come from supernova 1987 because that's the system with the highest temperature that we know something about. So let me now rapidly, all I'll do now in the next few transparencies, I'll just use this dimensional analysis. All you need to remember is that the graviton emission rate scales like the Planck mass to the n, to the negative n plus 2 power. So for example, let's discuss kaon. Here is this red box now is our three-dimensional wall, the three-dimensional space in which we live. So here is a process that gives rise to kaon. A kaon turns into a pion and a graviton is emitted into the bulk in the process. Okay? So the dimensional analysis we just did shows that the branching ratio will be proportional to the available energy, which is the kaon mass over the fundamental Planck scale to the n plus 2 power. Even if you set n equal to 2, which is the smallest number of extra dimensions that is not already excluded, this is adequately small for a Planck mass of a TeV. Astrophysical, oh, it's like, this is like 10 to the minus 12, 13, yeah. Numbers, yes. Yeah. Okay, astrophysical constraints, there are several astrophysical constraints to consider. Sun, whose internal temperature is a keV, red giants, which are about an order of magnitude hotter, and finally the supernova, whose internal temperature during the collapse phase goes up to tens of MeVs. Okay? Now, many of the constraints I'm going to discuss, many but not all of the constraints that I'm going to discuss, are similar to axion emission constraints. So here, for example, you have the sun. There is some Compton scattering whose final product is a graviton which is emitted in the bulk. So here, the sun cools by evaporating gravitons into the bulk. Dimensional analysis, this is the rate. You can compare this to the corresponding rate for axions, which goes like 1 over f squared, where f is the axion coupling. And from the known limits on the axion coupling, you can translate it into limits for the fundamental Planck scale. Now, for the sun, because the sun is relatively cold, these constraints are not very important. And by far the strongest constraint comes from the supernova, which imply that the fundamental Planck scale is at least 10 TeV. And let me show you that. I will not discuss the sun or the red giant because it's just not as hot. So I'll go directly to the supernova. There is two processes that are important a priori. Nucleon-nucleon gravistrahlung, so two nucleons collide and graviton goes off into the bulk. And then there is Gravi-Primakov. A photon in the background of a strong high-Z nucleus can convert to a graviton. Okay, and in fact, the first dominates both for the action and here. But the second is also somewhat important because the coupling, this coupling is not suppressed by anything in particular. In the case of axion, it's suppressed by alpha. In the case of graviton, there is no small parameter. Things are only suppressed if they are not energetic enough. So you do all that, and it has been done, this analysis has been done more recently. When we did it originally, we found 30 TeV for two extra dimensions to be the limit for the fundamental Planck scale, which now I'm calling M star. Whereas for more than two extra dimensions, the fundamental Planck scale can still be 1 TeV. Okay? So for more than two extra dimensions, the scale is a TeV. For two, we found 30 TeV. Recently, Cullen and Perelstein, two Stanford students, did a much more careful analysis of the supernova, and they found 50 TeV for two extra dimensions. Please. This includes it. That's right. You see, you can think of the graviton in two different ways. You either think I have one six-dimensional particle whose coupling is 1 over a TeV to the right power, or you think I have many, many gravitons, each one coupling with a normal 1 over Planck. And the phase space of the first picture is the number of gravitons of the second picture. The phase space of the single graviton, number of four dimensions. Yes, please. Please.
On the point of the four dimensions, whether if one wanted to take this framework, whether one would have said that, well, we are gravity and we are commanding, they're both Lorentz forces. So let me have these forces only propagate in other directions. What completely goes wrong if I think?
For electromagnetism at a millimeter, everything, we would go wrong. Oh yes, that's right. By all everything, yeah, that's right. Everything. The limits, if you want electromagnetism to propagate in extra dimension, the limit would be like 1 to 10 TeV, because that's the level of accuracy, and that's not surprising. We know we can have supersymmetry at a TeV or hundreds of GeV, so. Now let me move to much more difficult constraints, which are cosmological constraints. Now, one okay, now I can show the whole thing. Okay. One of the most important aspects of early Big Bang cosmology, the one that checks in detail our ideas about Big Bang cosmology's primordial nucleosynthesis. Synthesis. Light element abundance is predicted to 10% or better. Okay. So we want to maintain this this success. This means that we don't want to change the standard Big Bang cosmology, in particular Big Bang nucleosynthesis picture, which occurs at temperatures of the order of 1 MeV or below. Okay. So in order to check whether it is possible to do that in this framework, is notice that at 1 MeV, you can still emit a lot of gravitons. 1 MeV is a high temperature. Remember, the supernova was like tens of MeVs, and we got constraints for that case. So the question is how whether this set of ideas can leave the standard nucleosynthesis story on change. So to answer this question, what we are going to do is we are going to introduce a temperature, which we will call T star, I will refer to it as the normalcy temperature, above which the universe can be normal. And as you will see in the next few transparencies, we will see that this temperature, T star, has to satisfy some necessary conditions in order not to distort our picture of the Big Bang universe, in particular nucleosynthesis. Okay? So T star is the highest temperature below which the universe is normal. So we are imagining that our three-dimensional space starts at the temperature T star, with the bulk mostly empty, not much gravitational gravitons in the bulk, the radius of the extra dimensions frozen to their final value, and we will start like that compute some constraints that have to be satisfied by T star and see if T star can be bigger than 1 MeV, which is the nucleosynthesis temperature. Let me give you an example. A very important ingredient for Big Bang nucleosynthesis is that the universe cools by adiabatic expansion, which is Hubble's law, and cools by adiabatic expansion with an expansion rate h that is determined by the normal four-dimensional Planck mass that we know. Okay? This enters in the rate calculations in a very important way. This is what determines how much time various microphysical processes, nuclear processes, have to happen. Now, however, we have a new potentially disastrous process for cooling the universe. Namely, the universe can cool by evaporating gravitons into the extra dimensions, into the bulk. So, for example, you can have in this hot soup, that is the universe, you can have particles colliding that give rise to gravitons in the bulk. Now, the rate of cooling, you can estimate, again, just on dimensional grounds, like we did before. And the requirement that the universe cools normally is equivalent to the requirement that the cooling by adiabatic expansion dominates cooling by evaporation, namely this inequality here. Okay. Now, you can plug in these numbers here, and you find the following. If you have two extra dimensions, T star, by this requirement...
Why is that expression for n equals 0?
For n equals 0, it's right? Oh, because... Yes. Why is this expression doesn't agree for n equals 0, you are saying? I'll tell you why. Because this is a different physical process. This is a process that has to do with the statement that when you have adiabatic expansion, the wavelengths of radiation stretch, okay, and the matter density dilutes. So the physics of this process and this process is totally different. The bulk is not expanding. The bulk is fixed. Because the definition of T star, at T star, the reason why we take the bulk fixed is the following. If the bulk was varying during the time of nucleosynthesis, then G Newton would be varying. This means that G Newton at the time of nucleosynthesis could be different than G Newton of today. But we know that we get the right element abundances by plugging the G Newton of today. And again, the direct
response. You could imagine it's more complicated.
Where the bulk has different size then than now, then gravity would be, say, if the bulk was smaller during nucleosynthesis, then gravity would be stronger. This means that the expansion rate, this expansion rate would be bigger. That would typically lead into problems, because if the expansion rate of the universe was higher, you would have less time for nuclear reactions. Probably you would get too much helium-4 because you wouldn't have neutrons decaying to protons. You would start out with roughly comparable numbers of neutrons and protons. You would get like 100% or much more helium-4 than the 25%. Yeah, and... The reason why these two are totally different physical processes, so they don't have to agree. Okay. Now, for 6, the temperature T star for 2 extra dimensions is 10 TeV. For 6 extra dimensions is 10 GeV. So definitely for 6 extra dimensions, it's comfortably higher than the nucleosynthesis temperature. And for 2 extra dimensions, it's just an order of magnitude higher. At this point, I can't say how safe this is, but it's not an NEV. Okay? Now, there are more important effects that by graviton overproduction. So far, the only thing that we did is to ensure that the kinematics of the universe, the cooling of the universe during nucleosynthesis hasn't changed. There are more important effects associated with graviton overproduction. For example, graviton, this is the bulk, gravitons can be emitted from our three-dimensional wall into the bulk, and the gravitons that are there in the bulk can overclose the universe. They can distort, they can decay. A graviton that is in the bulk can occasionally, as it moves around, as it wanders around the bulk, can occasionally come and interact with us and give rise, for example, to two photons. It can decay into pairs of photons on our brain, on our three-dimensional wall, and that can distort the gamma ray spectrum. So, and these in fact turn out to be stronger experimental constraints. And you find the following, that all of these considerations are satisfied if you have more than two extra dimensions with a fundamental gravity scale of about a TeV. However, if you have three, or if you have, and this is the numbers, for three dimensions you get 10 MeV, for six a jet. For two extra dimensions, you have to push the scale to 30 TeV in order that the normalcy temperature goes up to an MeV, just barely. So you have, again, as usual, again because of Gauss's law, you get for n equal 2 the strongest constraint. Now, these considerations have recently been done more carefully by other people. So here is a list of the strongest constraints. As I said, for more than two extra dimensions, TeV scale, quantum gravity scale, is okay. For two, supernova overclosing the universe and gamma ray distortions. Here is what we had gotten back in the summer. And here is more detailed recent calculations by Cullen and Perelstein, found 50 TeV instead of 30. Hall and Smith, from overclosure, found 6 TeV instead of our 20. And they found for gamma ray distortions a stronger bound. So this is the types of numbers. So the corollary, 1 TeV fundamental gravity scale is okay for more than 2 dimensions. For 2 dimensions, probably 100 TeV for the quantum gravity scale. At this level, I cannot pretend to be able to tell you this, but I'm sure Hall and Smith and the other more careful people could tell you, but I don't know which. But now we're talking about factors of three or so, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's true. Okay. I don't know which, so. I should say one more point since you brought it up. What I'm quoting, the limits that I'm quoting are strictly for the fundamental quantum gravity scale. The string scale can be easily lower than the fundamental quantum gravity scale by another order of magnitude. So that string scale physics could be accessible before. So let me end this part of my talk by summarizing why it is alive, the whole framework. This is just a one transparency summary of essentially the main reason why I will say Gauss's law in position state tells you that the gravity becomes weak very fast at large distances. Momentum space, same statement, that in the infrared gravity becomes soft at a very rapid rate. And the only thing you have to remember is contrasted with the axion, which went like 1 over f squared. And you see why the axion was excluded and this is not. Now that we have some hope that this framework can pass some basic tests, let me come and talk about the experimental signatures. And I will start with... Okay, here is let me just give you... Because I'll talk about several of them, I want to give you some bird's eye view first. There will be two classes. There will be tabletop and accelerator signatures. And tabletop will involve some millimeter force experiments. And these experiments can detect, in principle, two things. Either changes in the fundamental law of gravity, from 1 over r squared to some new force law, or the existence of particles with Compton wavelength of a millimeter. Okay? And the latter, as you will see later on, will be valid for any number of extra dimensions. As far as accelerator signatures go, there will be at least three classes. First, there will be missing energy signatures, where you have a collision on our space. So this is our three-dimensional space. You have two particles colliding, and then they emit a graviton into the bulk. Or you can have some virtual graviton-mediated process, which can mediate some four-particle interaction, four Fermi or otherwise. And finally, if you really have string theory at the TV, you'll have a plethora of new particles, vibrations of the string, etc. If you have new dimensions of TV size, you can see winding modes, and Kaluza-Klein states, and several things. So let me start, please. Yes?
If you collide particles
in
the TV, don't they form black holes?
You could form black holes. And in fact, that's right. The answer is possibly yes. Right, you could. And in fact, this I don't exactly know what the signature would be. Because if you go to higher and higher energies and you produce more and more massive black holes, they would be colder. And then you would emit a spectrum. You would increase your energy, but you would emit colder and colder particles at more and more multiplicity. So it would be, that's right. So it would be amusing. However, these black holes would mostly radiate into the bulk because there is more. I mean, as they evaporate, so because there is more phase space there. So as far as detecting it, you would have to be able to detect, you know, TV particles that move in the bulk, which may not be impossible because it's gravitons at the TV coupled with TV strength, inverse TV strength. So. But I haven't thought any more. They would, but the photons can only be emitted on our brain, whereas gravitons have the full bulk phase space. So, yes, was that? That's right. That's right, much more than that. The center of mass energy is like in the hundreds of thousands of TeVs. If you take a very energetic cosmic ray, and let's say it collides with a nucleon, the center of mass energy is like 100 or 1,000 TeV. Right. That's right. So I think it's more. But it doesn't... That's right. You see, this is a very good question. The reason is the following. Having enough energy is not enough. You have to have large momentum transfer. In other words, consider two particles, one at one end of the universe, the other end of the universe, with huge energies. They're not going to make... Center of mass energy is not important. The important quantity is momentum transfer. The point is to have a process with momentum, with very large momentum transfer, relative to a process with little momentum transfer, you pay a huge price. Okay? So if you have, for example, two nucleons at 100 TeV center of mass energy, the vast majority of the time, they will undergo what's called a peripheral collision, you know, with 100 MeV, QCD, momentum transfer. And to have high momentum transfer, you have to have millions of events. That's why we need high luminosity machines like LHC to study high Q squared. Those are soft. This is a series of soft processes. There is no characteristic Q which is, you know, above a TeV. It would be great if we could do... I will not kill the framework on the basis of those. It's okay. Okay, we haven't thought about that. Okay. Okay, so so then okay, so let me go over these things. First, let me discuss a little bit submillimeter experiments. Now, so first for submillimeter experiments, the possibility that you will see transition, that you will see the extra dimensions by having a transition from a 1 over r squared to, say, 1 over r to the fourth force law, is a very big long shot. I think it's very unlikely. And the reason is precisely for two extra dimensions, the fundamental scale is at 100 TeV at least. So this is, I think, a long shot. On the other hand, as I emphasized, I'm not sure I'll have time to. In these theories, for any number of extra dimensions, you have particles, gravitationally coupled particles that get mass from the TeV scale, naturally have Compton wavelengths, de Broglie wavelengths, of the order of a millimeter. Okay, this is something that I may not have time to go into in detail, but if you have vector particles or scalar particles or particles in the bulk, they can naturally get this mass independent of the number of extra dimensions. And this is something you can see fairly easily. Furthermore, vector particles, for example, in the bulk, can mediate attractive forces which are a million times as strong as gravity, and so can scalar particles in the bulk. So there are interesting signatures from the existence of particles in the bulk that persist for any number of extra dimensions. And I may... Any scalar particle that you place in the bulk. For example, the dilaton could be a gravitationally coupled particle. If it gets its mass from TeV scale physics, this is a natural number for its wavelength. I'll mention also, if you gauge baryon number in the bulk or any global symmetry, and you make it, you take a global symmetry of our free brain and you convert it to a global symmetry of the bulk. Such a vector particle would couple naturally with these properties, this mass. Now you asked about the experiments. So here is a cartoon of two different sets of proposals. And these people, this is Price et al. In Colorado and Capitulli and Kenny et al. At Stanford. Now these people have many more ideas than what I'm showing here. I just chose two simple versions of their proposals, and at least in the case of Aaron, of Capitulli, he's pursuing more than one at the same time. Now, here is the Price et al. Setup. Take two infinitely large planes, and the gravitational force is constant. And then look for variations in the force law as a function of distance as indication of some non-gravitational force. And he has some setup, which I don't have time to discuss, where he checks for that. He couples one of the planes to some oscillator, and he vibrates the other one at this eigenfrequency, and he looks for excitations of the first plate from the second. Capitulli and Kenny et al., they have some very high Q oscillators called cantilevers. Okay? So these are some objects that vibrate like diving boards with a very well-defined frequency. And he's trying to measure the frequency shift of this as you bring another mass close to it. And of course, it goes without saying, the distances that I'm talking about here are in the 10 to 100 micron regime, so they are in the interesting range from our viewpoint. And I understand there are more ideas I don't have time to discuss. Obviously, one of the backgrounds that they have to face is van der Waals. Okay. Now, as far as missing energy signatures, there are several people that recently started studying in detail this missing energy process. So you can have in a lepton machine or in a hadron machine, you can emit gravitons into the bulk, which will appear like missing energy. And there are... Okay, I will... Okay, for very optimistic cases, such a signature might even be visible in low energy, relatively low energy machines like the Fermilab Tevatron. But this is for very optimistic cases, 6 extra dimensions, 600 GeV. This is background and this is signal. Now, another process having to do with virtual graviton. So you can have, for example, you can have in a hadron machine two gluons giving you E plus E minus by virtual graviton. So this has some This has been studied in detail by a bunch of people, Hewitt, Rizzo, and others. And this plot is sort of amusing. This is at LHC, dileptic production via glue-glue collision at the Large Hadron Collider with some parameters. The interesting point is that you get, this is the background can be 30 times less than the signal for, say, dileptic masses in the 2 TeV regime. So, yeah, I forgot the most important things. That this is with a fundamental scale of 2.5 TeV, so it's okay. No, for this one, I'll come. For this one, this process that I wrote down, it turns out that N cancels out for a very subtle reason that I can discuss in the questions. I can discuss it in the questions. But this is, yeah, N drops out because there is an ultraviolet sensitivity. Actually, it's the highest momentum virtual gravitons that contribute, which makes the calculation unreliable because this means you are sensitive to the cutoff. So if the cutoff is much less on the gravity scale, this will be a suppression. But we can discuss this later. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you do the same thing with n equals 0, you'd also get the same answer.
Yes, but your overall scale would be M Planck.
Oh, I see.
That's right. That's right. The overall scale would be M Planck. No, N would cancel out. The fundamental scale wouldn't cancel out. The final answer to this has dimensions of 1 over mass to the 4th because it's coupling of T mu nu to T mu nu. Okay.
But higher loops will be 1.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. So this calculation can only be done in a string theory context. So it's now being done by a couple of Stanford students in some... Okay. Here is a nice summary by Mirabelli, Perelstein and Peskin of going back to the missing energy signatures. These are various machines for various cases, 2, 4, 6 extra dimensions, and this is their reach. So let me just point a couple of things. If you go to the next linear collider for 2 extra dimensions, you can probe up to 7 TeV. Ah, this is the next linear collider with 1 TeV center of mass energy. Okay, you can go all the way up to 7 TeV. Or for 6 extra dimensions, you can probe up to 3 TeV. For LHC, similar, 3 TeV, 4 TeV, you can probe. And so these are the reaches. And now different people derive different plots with slightly more optimistic numbers depending on what assumptions you make about cuts and efficiencies. And finally, it goes without saying, there is a whole bunch of particles and new phenomena that can occur at the TeV, vibrations of the string, etc. Okay. Now, before I finish this part, I should mention perhaps that there are other interesting proposals that are very different from our framework. The differences are coming powers of 10 to the 16 that are nevertheless interesting. For example, of course, there was early proposals but for string theory, where things happen around the string or the grand unification scale. And although the phenomena were at high energies, they still, at least one version of these ideas, the Horava-Witten version, maintained a successful sine square theta weak prediction of supersymmetric grand unified theory. So there was one low energy prediction in that case. Then there were another set of ideas by Antoniadis et al. And by Licken. Antoniadis et al. Had the string scale in its old value. The largest compact dimension was at the TeV. And he presumably had new phenomena at the TeV. It's a little difficult to analyze the theories as they stand because the theory was non-renormalizable field theory from the weak scale all the way up to the Planck scale. So it's not quite clear how to discuss it. Licken et al. Had the largest compactification radii was also at the TeV, and the string scale was at the TeV. To explain the weakness of gravity, instead of relying in a big bulk, he relied on a tiny string coupling constant. So again, at a TV energy, presumably you could see TV particles. Here, of course, it's important to try to construct theories with such a small string coupling and order one gauge couplings. And but it's not totally clear what the signatures would be with such a small string coupling. Then there are other ideas that I don't have time to discuss. Lisa Randall was here recently and discussed. So the common theme of some of these ideas, many of these ideas, is that they still make some predictions, possible prediction for TV physics, and some of them may be worth developing further. And none of them, as far as I know, have any predictions. They don't have any large bulk, millimeter sized or large bulk, so they don't have new phenomena at submillimeter distances. Finally, I'm running short of time. My last topic was physics inside the extra dimensions. Because I'm running short of... Can I take 3 more minutes? I do? Okay, plus the questions. Okay, so this is actually one life without the desert, or doing physics inside the extra dimensions is one of the several new topics that are emerging. As we speak. Now, the standard desert paradigm is of particle physics provides us with not just a problem, namely the size of the desert, but it provides us with a big arena inside which we canonically have been doing physics since many of us since 1974. For example, neutrino physics, the explanation of the order of magnitude of neutrino masses, flavor physics, grand unification, are all phenomena and mechanisms that occur inside the desert. In addition, the desert, in addition to providing us with mechanisms for new phenomena, it explains some of the old mysteries of particle physics. For example, if you limit yourself to the standard model, the old standard model, not the supersymmetric one, you can understand a variety of regularities. For example, you can understand the stability of baryon or the stability of the proton as a consequence of the big energy denominator that is implied from the existence of this large mass scale. Or the smallness of the neutrino masses can be understood by an energy denominator. So the desert has been a very natural home inside which we do physics. In this new framework that we are discussing, we lose the desert, and a natural question is, what do we do now? What can we replace it with? And of course, a very natural answer is that we can replace it with a bulk. And the bulk, in particular, natural questions that we would like the bulk to provide us answers with is, how do we understand some of the small numbers in nature? Okay, so I want to discuss two possible classes of mechanisms by which small numbers can be understood from physics inside the bulk. Okay? The general idea, I should just say it in words first, is the following. The bulk, when we do standard field theory, we understand the smallness of some numbers by the ratio of some very different scales. Okay. When the bulk provides us with a new possibility for having small numbers, which relies on locality. The phenomena that happen in different places inside the bulk can be naturally decoupled from each other and can affect each other in a small way. For example, here is two. One way to get small numbers is that bulk fields, if you have a field that is spread out in the bulk, then it interacts with us very rarely. This was, for example, the reason why gravity was weak, okay? Because it very rarely encounters our free brain. And for the same reason, as you will see in a short while, you can understand the small neutrino masses or the couplings of vector particles that live in the bulb. Second possibility is that symmetries that are broken badly far away from us in a distant three-dimensional space, in a distant plane, can appear to be very weakly broken from our perspective, for the same reason that a star of unit luminosity can appear dim to us only because it is far away. And you can see, you can use these ideas to explain a variety of things: flavor, lepton number, and small baryon number violations. So I'll just discuss a couple of examples. So the basic picture is the following. The bulk provides us with an arena in which physics takes place, just like the graviton lives in the bulk. You can introduce new particles like the right-handed neutrino or some vector particles in the bulk, which also will interact naturally in a weakly coupled way. Second possibility for getting small numbers is the following. Here is us, okay? But we are not the only things in the bulk. There are other three-dimensional spaces that live in the bulk. In particular, there can be distant brains on which baryon number violation originates and is of order unity and is only communicated to us by a long-range field whose strength is suppressed on our brain. Okay. So you'll see now, and this idea, in fact, endows the bulk with very interesting dynamics. For example, if baryon number originates in a faraway brain today, if the size of the bulk is small early on, is its natural length scale, then baryon number violation can be suppressed today, but unsuppressed in an early stage of the universe. So let me now, and finally, this is another application of this idea.
Now you're allowing the bulk dimension to change.
Yes, that's right. That's right. At temperatures below an MeV, we know the size of the bulk hasn't changed because the four-dimensional plant mass from nucleosynthesis has not changed between then and now. Now I'm considering very speculative, very early cosmology scenario that I haven't discussed before. For example, another application of these ideas is that the chirality breaking interactions that are responsible for the tau, muon, and electron masses can take place at different distances away from us. And this can account for the hierarchy of the small numbers that we observe. So let me give you now some, at least one concrete example applying this idea, which is how you can naturally understand the small neutrino mass. Okay, so here is our three-dimensional space. Okay, so imagine now you introduce a particle in the bulk, a fermion in the bulk, that we will call nu right, okay, and couple it to the left-handed lepton doublet and the Higgs doublet, as usual. Okay, then, this is the coupling. Because the right-handed fermion's wave function, just like the graviton, is spread throughout the bulk, the coupling of the zero Kaluza-Klein mode of the right-handed neutrino to normal particles, so the left-handed neutrino and the Higgs, is suppressed by the square root of the volume of the bulk space. But the square root of the volume of the bulk, as you may remember, is equal to the four-dimensional Planck mass. This was from a very early equation. In units where m star, the fundamental scale, is 1, m Planck, the four-dimensional Planck mass, is precisely equal to the square root of the volume of the bulk. Therefore, you get neutrino masses that are naturally suppressed by the four-dimensional Planck mass. Well, and then you put numbers in. This is the weak interaction scale, and this is the fundamental scale. You plug numbers in, you find... In order of magnitude, the same formula that you get from the normal seesaw mechanism of neutrino masses of this order of magnitude. And so Neutrinos in this framework are light for the same reason that gravity is weak, namely they spread their wave function over the big space, over the bulk. And in fact, you can have variations of this idea. Neutrinos don't have to live in the whole bulk. They can live in a subspace of the bulk that happens to intersect us. And then the neutrino mass formula will be modified. Now, instead of spreading its wave function over the whole volume, you've spread it over a subspace, so it can get a bigger mass. This is another mechanism you can have, which, by the way, I don't know any field theory analog that would give you such a fractional, you know, power suppression for the mass of a neutrino. Okay. Then put gauge fields in the bulk. Okay, same story, identical story. You can do the you have some gauge field. Here is our three-dimensional world, quarks coupled to a gauge field. It can be baryon number, it can be something else. So now the gauge, the coupling constant, again, the effective coupling constant, you can easily work out, is suppressed by the volume for the same reason, because its wave function is spread throughout. 1 over the square root of the volume in, once you put the right numbers, is 10 to the minus 16. Now, notice that 10 to the minus 16 is, of course, a very small coupling. Okay, 10 to the minus 16 is the coupling of this U1 bulk gauge boson to quarks. However, compared to gravity, it is a very large coupling, because gravity couples with a strength which is m proton over m Planck, which is 10 to the minus 19. So in amplitude, this is 1,000 times larger than gravity. So in rate or in force, it is 1,000,000 times stronger than gravity. Then you can ask the question, how do you give a mass to this U1 gauge boson? You clearly cannot accommodate a massless gauge boson, which is 1,000,000 times stronger than gravity, repulsive force, etc. We wouldn't exist. The universe would be very different. So one possibility to give it a mass is to break this symmetry on another wall, on another three-dimensional wall, by some vacuum expectation value of the order of the fundamental scale. Okay? Then you compute its mass, which is g times the expectation value of this field, and you find that it's, of course, a millimeter. This is not surprising, because this number, if you compute it, is just TeV squared over m Planck, and that's equal to an inverse millimeter. Okay? So this is another possibility. Of course, you can do it with scalar particles in the bulk or vector particles in the bulk. That's
why
it. They are, actually. So you have to get constraints. This is a very interesting question. We have reworked all of the supernova constraints, and everything has to be reworked for these particles. And because, and in fact, there's a very simple scaling rule to convert the graviton bonds to these bonds. Bottom line is the following, that if these particles have for 4 or less, like extra dimensions, these particles would cool the supernova too rapidly. So there are stronger bounds because of their larger coupling. If you have such particles and the fundamental scale is a TeV, then the number of extra dimensions has to be right. So these also get separate constraints, which are stronger. This is assuming that it's something of like baryon number that they couple to some combination of baryon and lepton number. It would work the same way. Right, they are more constrained. Yes. And, okay. Then, let me just give you a glimpse of how you can get how you can apply these ideas for getting small numbers to the problem of flavor. For example, here is our wall. Here is a Yukawa coupling. Imagine that the Yukawa couplings that we normally think of as numbers in our Lagrangian are actually dynamical bulk fields. Okay? Then, if they are dynamical bulk fields, and imagine that they are being shown, or their origin, there are sources in distant brains that shine these Yukawa fields to us. Then again, the same idea. So these sources are the sources which are responsible for the electron, for example, chiral symmetry breaking. Then again, if these sources are far away, the electron chiral symmetry can be broken by order 1, but due to the distance suppression, we would see a smaller Yukawa coupling on our wall. Now, these ideas appear to be fairly abstract. They reduce, and then if you want to pursue this to the ultimate, you can do the following little arithmetic. There is two quarks and one lepton mass matrix, 3 3x3 matrices, so there are 27 elements. So for each, the absolutely simplest idea, which requires no model building. That's right. So this is, of course, the absolutely, you know, most boneheaded way of implementing this distant shining suppression. So each one of the elements of all the quark and lepton mass matrices could come from this. Now, and then, as I said before, the question of fermion masses would have to do with how distant drains can be arranged in the bulk and shine the various violations of symmetries in a distant-dependent way. Now, for reasons I will not discuss, actually, this is work in progress with Nimar, Kani, Hamed, and Lawrence Hall. It turns out that one of the major problems of extensions of the standard model, whether especially technicolor, but even supersymmetry, is the problem with flavor-changing neutral currents. And these ideas that I outline can actually lead to theories of flavor without flavor-changing neutral current problems. And I'm running out of time, so let me... Okay, you can apply this idea now to many other things, baryon number violation, etc. It's the same thing, so I will skip this. So let me... So there is several other topics that, I mean, I'm not... that are under progress, different state of progress. For example, one of the outstanding successes of the standard supersymmetric framework is this famous picture of coupling constant unification. This is perhaps the only numerical concrete evidence that we have for perhaps some physics beyond the standard model happening at some high length scale. And if any extension that is not supersymmetry has to address how come this works so well. At the moment, the answer is we don't know, and we don't have an answer. However, we are working on it, and stay tuned. Maybe in a short time we can tell you something positive. So there is some possibility for coupling constant, logarithmic coupling constant unification, similarly for radio stabilization, and these ideas make use... Then, as I mentioned, for flavor, there are some possible ideas for how you can generate flavor without flavor violations, which again is an outstanding problem even for supersymmetric theories. It requires tremendous constraints on the 125 parameters of the minimal supersymmetric model. And finally, there is a lot of progress that has been made in very early cosmology, pre-nucleosynthesis. That are. How do I summarize? Well, so we discussed a new framework for particle physics. One of its possible values is that it gives a fresh outlook on old problems of particle physics. It suggests totally new experimental tests of the theory. It definitely suggests a lot for accelerator experimentalists that they have to look now. It's not enough to look for particles. There is a lot more that potentially may be happening. And last but not least, this set of ideas appear to revitalize the dialogue between theory and experiment. And there is a hope, perhaps distant hope, that very fundamental theoretical questions can, in fact, be directly accessible to experiment. And finally, I cannot resist ending with a poem given to me by Michael Pesky. Thank you.